Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever our viewers are watching. Welcome to another episode of the Green Life Farmer podcast with your host today. I'm the lead host today because Sagir is deciding to take a bit more of a back seat, right? So you're with your host, Ghulam Haider, and co-host, Sagir Ahmed. And today, this morning, afternoon, evening, depending on when you're watching, we have a special guest with us today who we've often had discussions with. You might see him on Twitter. Sometimes he's quite prolific. None other than our Chris Maguire, who is the marketing manager for UK and Ireland for BD Diabetes Care. BD stands for Benson and Dixon. In the pharmacy world, it stands for twice daily. And Chris, I'm going to put you on the spot here, because just before we joined the call, you asked me not to introduce you as this, and I'm going to just do it. He is the Northern Irish Brad Pitt.
I don't think anyone would ever agree with that, but thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you for agreeing to come on to our show this session. And we're hoping to extract lots of different pearls of wisdom from you, gems from you, advice, get your opinions and your sort of ideas on lots of different things that are going on in the healthcare sector, because you've got such a vast experience working in the community pharmacy setting, in primary care, and now obviously in the pharma industry. So we're hoping we can, if you don't mind, share some industry secrets with us. Yeah, keep us in the loop of what's going on.
We can try, but I'm not promising anything.
Yeah. So Chris, the reason I've actually put you on is because obviously we've met several times at our conferences, at exhibitions. We've also tried to work with you on an initiative in community pharmacy that didn't really launch because of many different obstacles at the time. But your career is quite interesting. First of all, you're not from mainland England, right? But you obviously live and reside in England at the moment. So a bit of background about yourself. Where are you from?
Originally from Cookstown in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland, which is about 45 minutes from Belfast.
Okay, so is that north of Belfast?
Yeah.
North of Belfast. Okay. So what's the sea called, that scenic route that everyone...
It's the Gold Coast of the Antrim Coast.
That's it. Yeah. We call him niece in an Asian household. When they call you uncle, you actually become the niece, don't they? So I have a niece that's studying somewhere on the Gold Coast at a university there.
It is a lovely part of the world.
Yeah. Okay. So you studied at the university. What was the university called?
It's Queen's University in Belfast. So obviously studied pharmacy there, did it 4 years, and then did my pre-reg. I moved back home after 4 years of being out of the house, and then moved back in with my mum and worked in a community pharmacy about 20 minutes from where I live and where I actually went to secondary school. So kind of went back to my roots a little bit.
Excellent. And you discussed a lot of this in an article that you did for which website?
Pharmaceutical Journal, I think.
Pharmaceutical Journal. And there's another one as well. It's called...
Pharmacy and Practice.
Pharmacy and Practice. That's a PIP, wasn't it? But that's what it's... That's why I wondered what the acronym stood for. Okay, excellent. And so how long did you actually work in community pharmacy for in Northern Ireland?
It was only the year of pre-reg, and then I think I worked for I did four locum shifts after I finished my pre-reg for the small chain that I was working for. And then I started getting job opportunities in the mainland. So I think I got a job offer for the same chain, but it wasn't exactly what I wanted. I thought I was worth a little bit more. I realized what people in England were getting paid, which was nearly, and it's very financially driven, it was nearly £15,000 more than what I was getting offered in Northern Ireland, because we still do get paid a lot less over there. So to do the same job, I just thought, well, why not come to England and see what that's like? And I can always go back if I don't like it, but
I really like it. Yeah, now I've got a bone to pick with you, Chris. Well, Sergei, you should have this bone to pick with you, because look, especially with the shirt behind you and where Chris decided to move to, considering the club he supports. So I'm going to hand over to you now, Sergei.
I know Chris is a Man U fan, but everyone in Ireland is pretty much a Man U fan, apart from the odd Liverpool fans that you have scattered around here and there anyway, don't you?
That's right. But where did you decide to end up living, Chris? Interesting.
So yeah, I had three options when I was leaving Northern Ireland. I was either to go to Edinburgh, Liverpool or Manchester, and I based my decision on where my best mate was. I wanted to have someone that at least I knew that I could hang about with and Irish culture, go for a drink with. So I ended up in Liverpool because I knew more people here than I did in Manchester or Edinburgh, which has been a challenge with obviously supporting Man United.
Okay, so it's nothing to do with supporting the football club, right?
Yeah.
Because we can end this podcast right now.
Yeah, definitely not. Definitely a Man United fan. I've had to hide my scarf many a times on my way back on the train or in a car, just to...
Chris, I've got a question for you in regards to pharmacy in Northern Ireland. So, one of my first roles when I was at Well, I used to be services manager for our division, and Northern Ireland was part of the division I used to cover. So I had been over a few times, but I know pharmacy economics there are quite different to England, and I know the pay rates are very different. Why? What? How come as a pharmacist you earn much less in Northern Ireland than you do over in England? And it's not as if there's a plethora of pharmacists out there either.
I think it was a little bit of supply and demand, is my own opinion, because I think we have something like 150 pharmacy students pumped out every single year, and they're all very high caliber to get into Queen's. It's pretty much straight A's that you need to have. Nearly everyone wants to stay in Northern Ireland as well, so they all try and get into their hospital or community. And then I think with people not leaving, with you can't get a new pharmacy license either. So it's not like you can open new ones. It's whoever's there at that time, they keep that contract, and it's super, super expensive to buy a pharmacy there. Yeah. So it's a little bit of an oversupply with lots of people who want to stay there. So a lot of people either move across the water or we start moving to the Republic of Ireland to try and work as well.
Am I wrong in thinking that most pharmacists go down to the Republic then?
It's a little bit of a weird migration, because a lot of Irish students end up going to places like Liverpool, Sunderland and loads of different unis. They all then migrate back to Northern Ireland to try and work there. You then have all the pharmacists that have been trained in Northern Ireland. So it really, really depends. There's a good few of us that come across England. A lot of us try and stay living in Northern Ireland and just cross the border to go and work down there. And others will just kind of up and move to Dublin or Galway or Cork, but again, there's pharmacy schools there, so it is very, very competitive on Ireland, because everyone wants, I guess, a good job with a job at the end of their degree.
And I know obviously Northern Ireland is part of Great Britain, the UK, and no longer part of the EU, which is a further complication now. So, with regards to pharmacy accreditation, do you need to be registered with a different board to work in the Republic? And now, especially with the added complication of EU being, you know, Ireland still being part of the EU and the UK not being part of the EU, has that added a further layer of complication?
Well, already Northern Ireland has the PSNI, who's who you have to be registered with. So if you're registered in Northern Ireland, you're not registered with the GBHC. So even for a UK pharmacist, if you want to go and work in Northern Ireland, you have to get registered. There is I think they allow you to do that. You just have to apply. But for the Republic, I think it is quite similar. You just have to show your certificate. They give you accreditation, but who knows what that's going to mean after Brexit's finally in.
So technically, I know you could be registered like yourself with the GPHC. What was the Northern Ireland board called?
PSNI.
PSNI. And then with the board in the Republic of Ireland as well.
Yeah.
There's no like conversion exam or anything like that you have to do, or further exams, no?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that makes it, obviously, in terms of being registered with three boards, do you have to then have to do three revalidations and peer reviews and all that?
I think so, yeah.
Times three, yeah? Wow. I don't think it's a game that we won't survive.
Well, I struggle with the one, mate. But Chris, you know what? It'd be really good to hear from you. One of the most interesting things that we've learned about you is how you've crossed into different sectors in pharmacy. And now it's becoming a bit more prevalent to do so. You've got to have a bit of a varied portfolio to be able to develop your career. Mm. You've been doing this for quite a while. So it'd be really cool to understand how you managed to do that when there were probably more obstacles in your way back then than there are now. And for the listeners to be able to glean a bit from you on how they could start mimicking some of the things that you've done.
Especially early on. And I actually forgot to mention, and you mentioned in your article, you took a year out working in the good old Australia, with the shrimp on the barbie, in secondary care, didn't you, as well? So you've worked multiple sectors within pharmacy.
I've done all four, I think, technically. So I guess community pharmacy for me, I joined Lloyds and I was working in North Wales. I was commuting out from Liverpool and I was really, really lucky because they started sending me back home to help recruit people to Lloyds. And through that, I got a bit of a profile, I guess. And then I ended up getting to be a cluster manager and everything was going really well. I was getting probably too work focused. So that's why I ended up taking my year out. And I was like, well, I've worked for 3 or 4 years now in community pharmacy. I can see where my career is going. But if I do that, I'm never going to travel. So took my year out, went Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and lived in Sydney for 6 months and worked in a hospital. But when I came back, I think I didn't want to go back to community because I tried it. I thought hospital, I didn't have the experience maybe, because a lot of my friends had worked in hospital. They were doing diplomas. They were doing all these things. And for me, I was like, I've only worked in community, so they maybe won't consider me. So whenever I was still in Australia, I got in touch with a recruitment agency back here and said I wanted to do something different. I didn't want community. I didn't want hospital. Try and find me something else.
Even with that 6 months experience in hospital, did you not feel that was sufficient to apply for a job?
It's a different system in Australia. At the time, they kind of forced you to have lunch breaks. They were like, you're not allowed to work more than your contracted hours. They had enough staff that you were completely covered at all times. So from everything I heard back here, it was a completely different level of scrutiny or a level of work, because in Australia, I think it's set up correctly. They have the right amount of workforce to do the right amount of jobs. Whereas here, it seems like you stay an extra 2 or 3 hours, or you're left on the wards by yourself, or you're left in the dispensary by yourself. And it seems way more stressful here in terms of the expectations compared to Australia, where they have that work-life balance really, really nailed down. So for me, I decided I didn't want to go down the hospital route. I wanted to be more on a commercial side or more in primary care. So I thought, I was given two options. I was actually given a choice to go and work in an online pharmacy, kind of like in a warehouse. And I went and met those guys when I came back. And it was just a very weird, weird experience of being shown around and being asked if I really liked industrial language and would I be okay working with these guys. And it didn't seem like pharmacy to me. The role that they were showing me was overlooking OTC sales pretty much. And I was like, no, that's not enough. And then I was given an opportunity to work for a company called Interface Clinical Services in primary care. Mm. And then that's where I ended up going. And I was there for 5 years and did a lot of different roles for them. And I think those roles, between being what they would have called a clinical pharmacist, a senior clinical pharmacist, a service development manager, and then a national lead pharmacist, gave me a lot of project management skills that let me understand how the NHS worked in a completely different way. I was working with bodies like AHSN's, Academic Health Science Networks. I was working with CCGs, health boards, and loads of different organizations. And that obviously then becomes a little bit either interesting or attractive to pharma or med tech, because you understand how things work and you understand the payment systems or what the power is within the NHS. So I was able to move to industry to be a project manager. Did that for a year.
Hold on a sec. Let's pause you before you get there. You're moving too fast, right? You remember that song? Moving too fast. So you're with the Interface Clinical Services, right? Now we know, obviously, and you've been involved in these discussions, I've seen it online as well, where pharmacists in primary care over the last few years has become a popular thing, right? There's more and more. The first there was the NHS clinical pilot and sending pharmacists into GP surgeries where they're funding those positions. Came, which you probably know, Iman Healthcare, one of our client pharmacies companies, they have the integrated split pre-reg program. and then HEE adopted this now with Health Education England doing funded split programs. And now you've got primary care networks and primary care network pharmacists. So there's a big buzz around pharmacists in primary care. But yeah. you were doing this like how many years ago?
I started there about 8 years ago, and I was there for 5 years.
Okay, so it was I might be out of touch with this, but it must have been quite a niche area back then for pharmacists, or at least not as popular as it is now for pharmacists working in.
I think there was, because I would have worked in, I worked pretty much all over the Northwest, and then later kind of all across the UK. It was rare to come across a practice pharmacist. There was a lot of meds management, and they would have been in and around practices, but there was some pharmacists in practice working as independent prescribers, but it wasn't as common. And I guess that was the niche. I think Interface had been running for nearly 5 years, 6 years longer before I had joined. So they'd been doing it for quite a while. But yeah, it just started to kind of take off and boom. I think when I joined the company, there was maybe 15, 20 of us. And as I left, there was nearly 100. So
wow,
it was quite a big expansion for them to keep going into Scotland, Wales, the Southwest, the Southeast, and the structures that kind of came with that and opportunities that came with that.
So what was so good about Interface Clinical Services in the sense that what work did they offer primary care, and what services did they offer and what outcome did they make?
So a few different things. They worked in different long-term care areas, kind of always QOF linked, or quality outcome framework linked. And it was to either do kind of medication reviews in around, anything from osteoporosis, diabetes, respiratory conditions. And it was to go in. We would count ourselves as the experts on how to do searches and run diagnostics on EMIS, System 1, Vision, whatever. I think it was 5 or 6 systems we can work on. Put that all together and be able to show these patients fall outside of the NICE pathway. They're not being controlled in the right way. They're not being managed in the right way. Or they're not maybe on your formulary in the right way. So then we would go in and make that advice, I guess, to say, we need to change this. This needs to happen. This patient needs reviewed. They need brought in. They need this kind of assessment. And by the end, we were actually doing QOF engagement to kind of say, well, actually, you're missing out on getting paid from these patients that you've done X, Y, and Z already for, but you've not actually give them a code here or there, or you've not added this on or that on, or you've not reviewed this letter in the right way.
If I can summarize that, sorry to interject, it's 4 points really. So you're helping with prevalence.
Yeah.
You are helping income generation by hitting QOF for certain chronic condition registers.
Yeah.
You are helping, so that's income generation. You're helping compliance in terms of local and national drug formularies so that CCDs were happy with them, right? And lastly, from a safety perspective, you're making them adhere to NICE guidance and the best practice.
Yeah, 100%. So something like the atrial fibrillation review we were doing, we were finding people with CHA2DS VAS scores that hadn't been done, or they had a very high CHA2DS VAS score and they'd never even been considered anticoagulation.
Yeah.
It was really nice, impactful work. Some of it's been taken up by NICE for the different reviews and the different work that they've done nationally. And it was really, really nice work to be doing, and then to educate other pharmacists on how to do that properly and then work with GPs and make sure that works.
It's interesting because obviously I split my, I've got two parallel careers. I work with Green Life Clinical Services and I also work in primary care where I'm a prescribing pharmacist, and I've got a bit of an advanced role in the practice that I work in, some seniority. And a lot of this, falls into the hands now of a pharmacist and they're bringing it more in-house. But I guess your company or others probably set the scene in terms of what a pharmacist could really do in general practice.
A little bit. I think it's moved on now because there's people that are doing their ACPs and they're running all types of clinics. We had to stick very strictly to protocols, and this is the kind of way that you would do it. This is where you would refer back to the GP. Yeah. So I think it's moved on from a little bit of where we were when I was there.
But what I mean is those GPs, surgeries or practice managers that you interacted with, they probably never had an interaction with a pharmacist before. So you just through your interaction and the work that you're doing, you're educating them of the potential of what pharmacists in primary care can do and beyond possibly.
It was quite funny. I'd say at the end of, like, when I was about to leave Interface, the amount of jobs I've been offered from primary care places that I'd worked, because I'd been working in them for maybe 4 or 5 years. They knew me. I was kind of in and out. You kind of become part of their team. Mm. And they were all trying to offer you jobs to go there, which is quite nice because it means you're actually either one, you're nice to be around and they like you, or you're very, very good at your job and they kind of want that input in the practice. So
it's nothing to do with being a Northern Irish Brad Pitt, no?
It's always the accent. It's always the accent. Anywhere in the Northwest with this accent, it's not too bad.
Yeah. By the way, Sergey, Chris has a problem with Brad Pitt trying to impersonate the Northern Irish accent.
Awful. In Devil's Own, he actually pretends he's from Cookstown, where I'm from, and his accent is probably one of the worst Northern Irish accents I've ever heard. When he does Snatch and he does that accent, perfect. My accent, no.
He's offended. He's offended. I'm sorry on his, you know, I don't know Brad Pitt, but I'm going to apologize on his behalf.
Thank you.
So when it came to leaving practice and then getting this role with BD, right, how did that transpire? Why did you just stick with practice?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question, because I was thinking the same thing here, because you're in such a like position. Like I said, look, I am in a position now where I'm thinking you were doing this a long time ago and I'm just doing this really for the last 4 years, 5 years, right? So you could have really stayed in primary care, become a real like pioneer and expert. You've got the networks, you've got the people skills, you've got the management skills, and you could have gone on. Were you a prescriber, number one? And did you want to pursue a clinical route down that, becoming an advanced practitioner?
Yeah, like it was something I'd considered. I'd asked to do my independent prescribing and I'd asked for all those types of things. And I think by the time I was leaving Interface, the more people that were kind of getting into primary care roles were kind of already on that pathway. So I kind of felt if I had been joining, I would have been taking like 2 steps back. Wow. So I was quite good in Interface, knew what I was doing. I was training 90 pharmacists. I had kind of control of developing the services and all that sort of stuff, which was great. But then if I was to go and work in a practice, I kind of felt it was 2 steps back career-wise. So from a career focus point of view, I've always wanted to live abroad. So Australia was great. But I either wanted to go to America, to Europe or Canada or somewhere else. And I think staying within primary care or the NHS, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. My wife's a teacher, so she can move. So I was the stumbling block to that. So I thought at least if I got into industry, I would have more chance of moving around the world and maybe getting to live in other places rather than kind of having to stay within the UK.
Do you reckon part of that is because you're from Northern Ireland and it's quite common for people from Northern Ireland or Scotland to move out of the country and emigrate, even if it is just to England, while over here in England will be often taking the more safer option of just staying where they are?
Possibly, yeah. Like I'd say there's a lot of my Northern Irish friends that were in Liverpool, I'd say there was maybe a group of 30 of us at one point, all from Northern Ireland, and there's maybe 4 of us left. They've all moved home. So there is that thing of Irish people like to get home eventually, but I've never really been that way. I've spent loads of time in America, Canada and Australia, and I've always kind of seen myself being there. So I'm not tied to being in the UK. I'm not tied to being in Liverpool. My wife is from here, but she's quite open to going and living somewhere else as well while we're still young.
Who does she support?
Pardon?
Which football club does she support?
The bad one. Liverpool. Whole family of them. Christmas is fun.
Replace her.
Right. Okay. So you went. So from Interface, you went into Benton and what's it? Benton and
Beckton Dickinson.
Beckton Dickinson. Sorry, I was thinking of Benton. I just right. I'm only joking. And so, what was your first role with BD?
It was funnily project management, but it was to manage Interface. So my previous company. So I'd been headhunted to come over and manage people like Interface Clinical Services and other third parties that they were kind of working with from a market access strategy, how they were engaging with NHS. So my first role was to kind of come in and do that to make sure that they were getting the best out of all the partnerships and the way that they were engaging with NHS.
Okay, and what, so obviously BD work in several different clinical areas, but which clinical area were you specifically working in?
Straight into diabetes care. So like BD has 9 different business units, everything from like diagnostics to like tests for COVID-19 or strep A to like really, like, I don't know, really advanced cancer kind of stuff, to robots that go into pharmacies and hospitals, to, I think we just bought Bard about a year or two ago, so catheters and stents that go in for cardiac surgery, to Vacutainer blood tubes and lancets and syringes, to then the diabetes business. So it's,
and to be honest with you, I don't know if, again, this could just be my limited subjective experience, but a lot of people don't know that BD are involved in all of these different areas. They just think that it's limited to diabetes. And on a funnier note, we're on this Telegram group. There's a guy called BD Autofine as a username, right? Just, can you put the disclaimer out there that he doesn't belong to you guys?
I've checked with him a couple of times why he uses that name, and I think it's just because of the meme that is there, because you are ultra fine.
Right.
I get sent way too many times.
I didn't even cotton on to that. I'm quite slow. All right, okay, brilliant. So you worked in diabetes. So how's your role advanced in terms of specifically diabetes? Like, what did you do?
So I did the project management role for a year, and as I was here, the marketing manager had just left, and my boss, who is a CBL or country business leader, he kind of saw all the stuff that I was doing in terms of kind of setting the agenda for what we should be doing with the sales team, what the messaging should be, how we could interact with NHS, and he was like, actually, you're doing a marketing role, that is what marketing is. So he was very, very nice and give me a chance to step into that role and step up and to be the market manager for the UK and Ireland. And I've been doing that for about the last 2 years. So
to contextualize that for our listeners and viewers, what does that actually mean, being the marketing manager? Like, because you're obviously a pharmacist, that's your professional background. So you come from a clinical background. But the role that you have doesn't necessarily require you to be a pharmacist, does it?
No, not at all. I think for me, it's very much it's a business role. It's a financial role. I have a budget. I'm responsible for the P&L for the entire UK and Ireland. I work with pricing contracts with everything from NHS supply chain to the wholesalers like Alliance and Phoenix and AIH. I help come up with the different collateral and the different projects and different campaigns that we use. So if we're doing advertising, if we are doing roadshows, if we're doing congresses or events, if we're coming up with material that we could send to GPs, diabetes nurses, if we're coming up with services, so it could be like an e-learning platform, it could be anything like that. I kind of have a role across the entire business of either how BD is perceived and then how we communicate that message out alongside. And because I am a pharmacist, I've ended up taking on more interest in the clinical marketing aspect, because I think that we weren't maybe the best there. So it's been a aim of saying, well, this is the clinical marketing message that we could use with diabetes nurses. This is what we could use in primary care. And then this is how the services that we have could actually benefit hospitals, primary care, et cetera, et cetera. So it's,
I hope they supplement your wages for that, because you're almost like, on a serious note, it's if typically these roles are given to non-clinicians, aren't they, in pharma companies. But you're not only bringing that expertise that non-clinicians would bring, but you're also bringing a clinical angle because of your background in pharmacy.
I guess it depends, because I think BD is actually quite good for it, because the marketing manager in France is a pharmacist from a community background, and we have a European division head who's over an entire portfolio, and he's a pharmacist by background, but I think he went straight in on the industry and manufacturing side. So there's a few of us, but usually is reserved for someone that's either, I guess, done a marketing degree or has been in sales and then kind of progressed to.
So that might just be specific to BD, but I'm talking about generally across the pharma world.
It's not usually pharmacists. Okay. There's like clinical marketing, which would either be a pharmacist or a nurse, but it's quite rare to be the marketing manager kind of above that.
Fantastic. Congrats on having that role.
In such roles in industry.
Sorry, say that again.
Why do we have as many pharmacists in such roles in industry?
They're getting more common, being honest. So it's, for me, it's all about getting in the door. So if that's on the clinical side, if that's in sales, if that's in project management, regulatory affairs, as soon as you're in like a big blue chip company, they want to progress you. So you pretty much put down your career plan for the next 3 to 5 years, what you're interested in. And then those pharmacists are getting to move in between functions and in between roles to kind of either stretch themselves, prove what they can do. But it's nice. I know lots of people in pharma now that are pharmacists from backgrounds.
I mean, Sergey, I want to ask you a question. Now you've become a guest, right? Which is obviously your role with Green Life Pharma is head of operations and business development, right? And yes, you're a pharmacist, but in reality, you know, as much as you like to claim you're the best pharmacist in the whole company.
Claim,
emphasis on claim. It's more of a business role and development role and marketing and, you know, looking at P&L. Like what basically Chris just said, you're doing for a company, aren't you? So both of you are almost doing roles that are quite similar in different sectors. But not many pharmacists that graduate from, you know, the MPharm program will ever think about that trajectory of a career, would they?
I personally think a lot of it is down to when you leave pharmacy school, your train of thought is to become a pharmacist clinician, right? That's what's drilled into you over the 4 years. And then to be able to get a role in management in an area that you're not really trained at all. You have zero training in management. But to be able to get your foothold into management, you've got to have doors that are open for you. I was always quite fortunate that I had people that made my life easier in terms of that. And once you do that, it's really important that you start picking up these different skill sets. So when it comes to managing budgets and finances, you're not trained in this. You've just got to be able to pick it up. But just remember that when you're picking this up, you're always being monitored. You're always being watched on how closely you're able to pick up these sort of skill sets and then be able to apply it. And then you start learning skill sets which are really to do with accountancy. You're really learning marketing skills. You're really learning business development skills. You're learning skills to do with business planning. And it's how you start bringing that together to be able to say that on paper, you have these different skill sets that makes you a viable candidate to be able to take on these roles, which really are quite multifaceted. I think the role that I do, it adds to be a pharmacist, but could a non-pharmacist do it? Yeah. You know, and what they'll do, they'll probably be more skilled and averse in some certain areas than I am. You know, you might have somebody whose background is project managing. Yeah. They'll be better at certain aspects of the role and might need help elsewhere. Or a lot of the work that I do is very finance orientated. I've had no accountancy training at all. I've had to pick all this up. And maybe an accountant, accountants tend to be fantastic actually when it comes to these sort of roles because they're so process driven and they just look at how the money flows that they're able to pick up and these roles quite quickly in comparison to others. So you could almost have an accountant doing this role, but they'll have to have some assistance from elsewhere.
The different aspects of it. So I'm this is like turning into you two being guests now. What Chris, you obviously put your career, you know, like obviously a very quick version of this online, right, on the RPS website and on Pharmacy Independent Practice, right? Do you see yourself, and Chris, and Sergey, do you guys see yourself as maybe acting as mentors for people that might want to, you know, look into alternative careers within pharmacy or give them ideas? Because obviously, Chris, you put that article on there for a reason, right? Is it to get people thinking about actually don't limit yourself? There are other opportunities and there are other paths you can take. And if that is the case, and it wasn't because you were just bored one day and you wanted to write something, right? What's the next steps? How do you help people? And Sergei as well, like, how do you, because, you know, Sergei, you know, this is praise for him now. He's acted as a bit of a mentor for me, you know, because I used to work in a community pharmacy and I've moved on to that. I'm working in lots of different projects now, etc. But I don't see enough of that within pharmacists. I've seen pharmacists seem to want to pigeonhole themselves and then, you know, they end up being dissatisfied with their career and that leads to other issues.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I don't like calling myself a mentor, but I have mentored quite a lot of people and it has came from Twitter. So I think my frustration kind of with like the pharmacy media and stuff is that it is very much, you do community, you do hospital, you do maybe primary care, an industry, you're in a lab. And I was like, well, actually that's not correct for industry. There's so many roles and we're all so able to do all of them that it needs to be highlighted more. It's called pharma for a reason. And it's kind of based on a lot of what we can do. And I think the insights that we have are great. But the more I've spoken to people and the more that, like, I take phone calls from loads of people and we've been doing that for about a year or two now, talking to them about what they need to do and how they can get in, how they can change their CV, how do they sell themselves to these big companies or what skills or experience that they need to go get before they can get in. And for me, I just think there needs to be more of that sharing of knowledge. Like, I don't get anything from it other than a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling that I'm helping someone else get there. And I've seen 3 or 4 people finally decide that they have the confidence to apply for those roles and get into those roles. And they've been there for maybe a year or 6 months now. And it's fantastic to see, but there could be so many more of us. And I know it's competitive, but it's completely worth it depending on what it is that you want to do kind of going forward. And for me, pharma has such good career progression and ability to move and everything. It's just quite a nice career path to have on top of everything else that you've done.
Yeah.
I see it as this. I totally agree with Chris, with what he said. I'm quite happy to act as a mentor to others and have acted and do act as a mentor to others. But it shouldn't be up to me to seek out mentees. It should be for them to approach me, Chris, you, or whoever. And anyone who approaches me, I never turn them away. I know I'm busy, I have a heck of a lot on, but I have a responsibility to be able to share info that I've learned, just like other mentors that I've had who've been able to help me, and I will help others as well. The issue I have is, This is where pharmacists really annoy me in general, right? The lack of confidence or self-confidence that pharmacists tend to have about themselves is really annoying. And I think this is one of the biggest obstacles that pharmacists have in developing themselves and really pursuing themselves. And what it also does, it breeds this animosity within pharmacists. You know, we hear on these Telegram groups and WhatsApp groups and God knows every other sort of group that we're on, they love a good whinge and a moan and how things are so hard for them and everything is stacked against them. But there's a reason why, right? It's because as a collective, as a pharmacist, we have too much of a cohort that like to play the victim and they have aspirations to be able to achieve something, but there's lots of obstacles in the way. But that's life, right? But you've just got to toughen up, and you've got to be a lot more self-assured and confident about yourself. You need to be more self-aware about yourself. You need to know where you need to develop. You know, you need to know what skill sets you can bring to the table, and others. And there's a lack of self-awareness amongst people within our profession. Think about this.
So if I'm going to interject,
there'll be so much more potential for them.
So basically, Chris, you offer more pastoral support, and Sergei is of the school of tough love.
No, it's not necessarily tough love.
It's a bit of both.
It's an element of that, but you can't go through your life just saying that things are hard for yourself, and I don't know why others get more opportunities than me. Well, do something about it.
You're Mourinho, and he's Pep Guardiola or Klopp, basically.
Right. I'll take Klopp with the beard. I'll take Klopp with the beard.
Even though he's an Liverpool manager.
Hugs and kisses and love and
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
So coming towards the end of like our discussion, one of the other things that we wanted to discuss was about specifically about diabetes as a clinical condition, and then something that you kept private for a while, but then started to publicize recently, about something personal about yourself, and maybe link the two. So we know obviously diabetes is a type two diabetes is a condition where a person develops insulin resistance, and often is to do with their lifestyle, being overweight, and they end up becoming, you know, on oral medication, and in worst case scenario, if it progresses, they start taking, you know, things that they have to inject into their body, like insulin and other medication, right? So you work in that sector, so you've got clinical knowledge, you know, in terms of all your roles that you've done in primary, secondary, and even in pharma. But lifestyle, we know lifestyle changes is, we're beginning to really hit that message home that lifestyle changes are the real, is the real game changer when it comes to diabetes. Now, I'm not saying you had diabetes, but you know about the clinical area, but then also you've been on a journey of weight loss yourself. And I wouldn't normally bring this up because it's only because you made it public. So otherwise, it's just something private, isn't it? So just tell us a bit about, you know, diabetes as a condition, like summarized in what you think is the best way to treat or type 2, and link it in maybe possibly with what you've been doing.
So obviously with BD, we work with like needles. So we're nearly always on the insulinized bit. So with type 2s, we're at the very end stage. And the type 1s, we're there for like the continuity of whenever they get diagnosed. So it's very hard to say that there's the best way to treat anyone with diabetes. I think it's so individualized. I ran type 2 clinics for a very long time. And we talked about diet, we talked about exercise, we talked about the medication that they're on. But then you have to start thinking about socioeconomic factors and can they afford the food that you're talking to them about? If it's a cultural thing, is that what's common to them within their culture of what they eat and how they behave and stuff? So it's really, really difficult. And I think everyone needs to just be taken at for them. What's right for them? What can they afford? What can they do? What are those small changes that they can make, especially on the type 2 side? But for type 2, I think diet and exercise is probably the key. If you get it at pre-diabetes stage and you can do something earlier, amazing. As and when you've got a little bit older, and we've seen like people, who is it, the Labour Party vice chair or whatever, he was deputy leader, he's lost loads and loads of weight and he's went into remission. We've got loads of stuff now about low carbs and we've got all these different diet fads or diet kind of things being pushed out there. But again, it's only if it's sustainable and if it's only if it works for your lifestyle is what I would say in that regard. And the link, I guess, to me is from January to now, I've lost about 5 stone in weight.
Wow.
And disclaimer, I don't think I had pre-diabetes. I don't think I had diabetes or anything like that. I'm just lean. And I didn't like how I was looking in photos. I wouldn't let my wife take photos of us anymore. And finally, just kind of give myself a bit of a kick around Christmas and New Year's to say, this year, I'm going to change.
So I mean, even before the call, as I said, you know, I've known you for a couple of years now or maybe longer. Yeah. And you held the weight very well. You couldn't tell. So I was actually very, very surprised when you made that public statement on your Twitter, you know, to actually start sharing and documenting your journey. So you've lost 5 stones. People often talk about how many kilograms they've lost. You've lost 5 stones. So how have you actually done that? Like, you know.
So I guess it's nearly better to go back and say, how did I gain it? I think it was just, I travel a lot with work. I'm in the car. Like I drive down to London or down to Reading and that's 4 hours. I'll be flying over to Geneva or I'll just be traveling to different places. So a lot of time I'm like, service stations and Greggs and McDonald's and KFC and fast food or sweets and crisps. So I just wasn't eating properly. I was snacking loads at home. we would eat well. Like my wife's super skinny, she eats super healthy. So when I'm at home, I eat well. It's just, I think whenever I was out, it was worse. And at weekends, I was having like takeaway, maybe one or two nights where we would eat out. And it was just a little bit too much and there was no real activity at all. So I think I changed diet in January and in February, and I started making sure I was doing my steps. So I was doing like 13,000 a day. Then in February, it was like, I need to up it. So we started doing couch to 5K. And then over about 2 months, I learned how to run. I've not run since I was 17, 18, maybe 19, back at school or university when I was playing football or basketball.
Wow.
And then since then, I've just kind of kept upping the intensity, I guess, of running. I've kept the food consistent. I keep a very consistent diet now. No takeaway, no snacks, no sugar. It's pretty much low carb for the most part. If it is carbs, it's brown rice or black rice or like other kind of grains type of things, but never any white carbs, never any processed carbs, as much as I can help it. But every now and again, there's a chicken burger or there's something just so I feel like I'm not restricting, but
yeah,
it seems to work.
Excellent. So yeah, I can see the shadow in the background, by the way.
I dare not tell him not to go away because I've not had my windows cleaned for a few months now.
All right. Okay. I thought it might be a deal again.
this is a priority.
Excellent. So no, brilliant. So that's incredible because it's been manageable steps for you, hasn't it? It's not been, you know, going from one extreme just to another. It's been making slow, manageable, achievable adjustments and then maintaining it.
Yeah, it's just been lifestyle change. Like I've done diets and stuff before, but I tend to bounce back because it's not sustainable. Whereas, and I have, and it sounds really boring, I have the same thing for breakfast, I have the same thing for lunch, I've got the same snacks most days. And then for even a meal, we do a thing called Mindful Chef, which is dairy-free, gluten-free, and is usually under 600 calories. But if you ever follow me on Instagram, you'll see what I eat because I post up my meals most nights. And it's lovely. It's loads of flavor, always feel really full. And it's just kind of keeping to that. And then my running 3 to 4 times a week is just
excellent.
Good. So
I do get food envy when I see your Twitter posts.
Farm food, where it's at.
There'll be times when I'll see what you've got. And then there'll be times when I'll look at what I have. And then you just think, I wish I was at Chris's house.
I'm happy to cook for anyone at any time.
Not to say my wife's bad cook or anything like that before that gets...
So
what you've done here is personal changes. So you've made the conscious decision to say that I'm going to make a decision on my own health in reducing weight and reducing the risk of further conditions further down the line. Now we know with diabetes, this is a condition that's just going to become more and more prevalent in our population. I would say that public health have really failed on this, right? Because the numbers are going to increase significantly, the cost to the NHS is going to increase significantly. So what would you recommend in terms of systemic changes to reduce the number of diabetics that we're going to have and to be able to improve the health of our citizens?
Getting me onto political topics is dangerous ground. So it all needs to change, as you say, from a systemic point of view, a lot earlier in school. So PE for me at school was we played some sports and you're either good at sports or you weren't good at sports and some people would get disenfranchised. I wish I had been taught at that stage why it was important for me to exercise or why running could be so good. So you don't have to be better than anyone else at running. You can be your own pace, you can do what you want. But as long as you're doing some activity, why? But the same with diabetes, scare tactics doesn't always work with type 2s. You can't just turn around and say you're going to go blind someday, you're going to have issues with your kidney. It's not realistic because it's asymptomatic. You don't think about it. I'll deal with that in the future. And even those people that have it say, well, I'm going to die sometimes anyway, so I'm just going to enjoy my life. So there's a lot of mindset change to be done and a lot of education earlier, but I think that's the same education that needs to happen with politics and loads of other things. I just don't think we're given the right tools at an early enough age to understand, and we're kind of reliant on families to pass that down. And I think sometimes that isn't where you're always going to get the right information or the best information that's evidence-based, because it can be anecdotal or it can be what worked in their family. So I think it just needs to be done at an earlier age and with more importance. But again, that comes to summer clubs and evening clubs and all that sort of stuff. If kids don't have access to that, then it's very easy to get disenfranchised or not to understand why it's important to keep active.
So we need Public Health England to engage with, you know, schools and these afternoon schools and supplementary schools, etc. If they're not already, I don't know what they are doing or aren't doing in a more effective way, really, don't we? And get the right messaging across. I mean, my wife's an educationalist and she uses the word pedagogy a lot, right? Which is apparently how you different styles of learning and engaging and taking on messaging. And you know, really, that's the issue here. When we were young, you know, we didn't really realize the importance of certain things because it wasn't taught to us in the right way. So in this context, physical education wasn't taught to us in the correct way, in your context at least. And that's possibly had an effect in your, well, it has had an effect in your adult life, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think like a kid, I played Irish football, Gaelic football, I played tennis, I played soccer, I played all the sports and I was on teams. And I guess that's supposed to either ingrain into you that you should train 3 times a week. But for me, that was, I do training when I play sports. Whenever I stopped playing sports because I started to work and didn't have the same time and I moved to England and I wasn't in that same environment, that all kind of fell away. I didn't have a sporting thing and going to the gym was never really my thing. But that's why I think this COVID thing in terms of exercise for me, with the gyms being closed, I've been very happy being outside and running. And whenever the gyms do open, I don't think I would go. I think I'll continue doing what I do outside. But I think there's probably lots of people like me that either weren't on a sports team or have never been. So how are they supposed to know you need to train 3 to 4 times a week, or even just doing minor activities is enough? But it's just, I don't think it's there fully. I'm educated and hopefully kind of a smart enough guy, but I was putting normal lifestyle and work as a more important thing than looking after myself. So I think that's where it kind of comes in. And I think companies probably have something to do with that as well, to make sure that if you haven't got that earlier on, that universities, that educators and employers do have some sort of responsibility to kind of put that back into their employees, because that work-life balance, especially for mental health, is so, so important.
The other area which I think there needs to be work on is this relationship we have with food. I think at school there was very little taught to us about how you maintain a healthy diet, nutrition. But then even at uni, I don't ever recall there being any sort of work being done on nutrition. And when you're practicing, there's only so much you could be able to improve somebody's well-being when it comes to just therapeutics. You've got to look at lifestyle and diet as well. But I remember when I was working as a pharmacist, I was not well equipped to be able to go down this area of discussion with anybody, really, apart from just to be able to say you've got to maintain a healthy diet with carbs, protein. Mm.
It's very tokenistic. I mean, if I may, I've worked with, just putting a disclaimer out there. I have to criticize Public Health England here, but when I was working in community pharmacy, they had the healthy living, you know, pharmacy scheme and HLP, etc. But it just felt like campaigns and tokenism rather than really equipping pharmacists to be able to understand the nutrition and health, and then being able to help their public, you know, their communities with nutrition and help. I didn't feel, of course, you know, through my supplementary knowledge of this on my own back, maybe I am better equipped. But in terms of if I had to rely on Public Health England as an institution to equip pharmacists with being able to empower their communities on a healthy living about nutrition, on exercise, etc., I don't think they did that.
I don't think, as a pharmacist, you feel well equipped with having the correct sort of information, unless you go
out your way yourself.
But then again, I don't think GPs are either, right? And you really have to think, if you want people to be healthier, but you're your clinicians are just ill-prepared to be able to give advice on diet and nutrition, you're going to fail.
I think it kind of comes to cooking as well. So I always think of, like in school, we were never ever taught how to cook. We didn't have like that, whether it was home tech or I'm not sure what the subject's called. So I was never taught to cook. Again, that's kind of reliant on my family teaching me how to cook. But then if they've not been taught, then you kind of get into a bit of a cycle. Again, it comes down to money. What can you actually afford? Is it easier to buy a ready meal or some frozen stuff and just heat it up? I went to university and I was just heating things up in an oven. I don't think I was properly cooking, or I was heating up pasta and putting the sauce on it. So it wasn't real cooking. And it's only been the last maybe 4 or 5 years where I've learned how to cook by myself. Whereas if you had to show me how to do that stuff at school, I might have had more of an understanding of what I was putting into my body, maybe. But again, it's those practical things for what works for kids to equip them for later in life. It's not always maybe thought through in the right way. We're too obsessed with grades to make sure we pass maths, English, science, but we've kind of forgot that we need to equip them with other things as well.
Yeah, with long-term life skills that they'll need for to deal with mental health issues, to deal with physical health issues, etc. No, excellent points, guys. Excellent points. Right. Any final questions to go?
No, I think we've covered quite a lot. It's been a really good little talk here, covering quite a few things when it comes to career and development, and developing your portfolio, and then moving on to onto this area of diabetes and trying to improve patients' health and well-being, especially when it comes to this sort of sector. So it's been really good.
I mean, I would say one final thing. It's a comment, and I guess it leads on really well from what both of you have been saying, which is, I think healthcare professionals, both pharmacists and GPs, pharmacists in community and primary care, and obviously GPs in general practice, need to be better equipped in understanding nutrition, and you know, really understanding, not just a quick, a little overview and just giving some information. It's and then really then holistically being able to understand their patient stroke client stroke community, right? In a more holistic way. And what I mean by that is what Chris mentioned earlier, socioeconomic factors come into this. So you got to give bespoke advice that a person can really, that's applicable for that person. Otherwise they're not, you know, if you're going to give them just generic advice that really culturally is not appropriate for them from in terms of how much they can afford, all of these factors come into it, don't they? So again, there's another idea here. Maybe we could work on something.
Well, we've got something in the pipeline at an early stage anyway.
All right, okay, cool. So watch this. It's one of those watch this space, hashtag watch this space, yeah? Excellent. All right, Chris, it's been obviously really, really pleasant to have you on board. Thank you for coming on. I know how busy you are. I read that typical day article that you put on RPS. And I was like, how does this guy work like a machine? Yeah, exactly. So what we'll do, we'll post the link to those two articles when we release this video cast stroke podcast. And yeah, you know, let's all make a collective prayer for Manchester United to rise again and for the downfall of Liverpool. I was hoping the season would come to a premature end, either with null and void, or Liverpool being given the title with an asterisk.
Would have been nice.
Right. Okay. Well, again, you know, for our viewers and our listeners, you know, I hope you guys have enjoyed this very informative video cast stroke podcast. Do like, share, comment. You guys never comment. You comment privately to us, but you don't actually comment on the actual YouTube or Facebook post. It's nice to receive WhatsApp and Telegram messages as feedback. But we need that engagement on social media as well. Because that's what it's all happening, isn't it, Chris?
100%.
All right. Thanks, guys. And hopefully catch you guys soon. And take care. Signing out.